Well, my dear Lord, thanks for that very pleasant introduction. As you can see, I'm spending my whole life not being a deputy, not being an assistant, not being a secretary, and I'll never be a general. I don't have the most important job in NATO, but at least I have the longest job title, which is, at least it's a start, yes? First of all, I'd like to thank you, my dear Lord. I'd like to thank Jacqueline Jinks very much there at the back for putting up with my constant changes of date for this talk to you today and for not giving up on me. Thank you, Jacqueline. I'm delighted to be here. And also, I'm delighted to see so many people in the room. I bet if you're honest with yourselves that at least 90% of you on your way here said, do I really want to go and spend my lunchtime listening to this Shay guy when I can have a picnic in the park? But I'm very, somewhat heartened, in this world of globalisation to see that the puritanical spirit of duty and self-abnegation is still very much alive and kicking, at least in the UK. No, thank you very much for being here. Also, I'm also happy to see, because it means that the world is pretty much the same as it always used to be, that you can't have a talk about NATO without a question mark in the title. And so I'll do my best to, if not reply to the question mark, at least clarify what it means. I also see a couple of people in the audience, Nick Watts, Robin Ashby, who have heard me recently on previous occasions, which means that they're clearly going for the Guinness Book of Records record for masochism by being here again today. But I also see Pauline Neville-Jones, Dame Glyn Evans, some pretty formidable defence debaters. So as we get to the discussion, they in particular and some others of you may sort of echo what William the Pitt said about Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France, which was that it was a rhapsody in which there was much to be admired and absolutely nothing to agree with. And therefore, you may also find, hopefully, that my talk is a rhapsody, but you may not agree with everything I say. But the great thing about talking about the future is, of course, nobody's right and nobody's wrong. As Woody Allen said, I love the future. I want to live in it for as long as possible. And so today I want to look a little bit at where we are at the moment in the alliance and where I see things going in the future. The first thing, as we come out of Afghanistan, the end of the ISAF operation now being just little more than 1 year away, and as we go from what my boss, the NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, calls a posture of deployment to a posture of preparedness, being prepared for something, at least in the future, we go also into a kind of sort of context that NATO has never experienced before. I mean, in all the 30 years I've been in the alliance, even once the Cold War was over, and for a good sort of 30 years after the end of the Cold War, the basic parameters didn't change. We had lots of money and lots of people. We had a problem. We had 26,000 people in the NATO command structure. Today, we can't find 7,000. It's a push. We had 14 NATO agencies to help us with the capabilities. Today we're down to three. We had at least double the number of battalions on duty in Europe that could be deployed to what we have now. The United States was always the default option that could provide 100% of the capabilities in critical areas like surveillance, air transport, lift, tanker refueling, the sort of capabilities that the Europeans traditionally lack, so you could always rely upon the US to bail you out in a difficult situation. The alliance had a basic consensus about what the threat was, and above all, we had one big thing to do. It was a tough thing, like enlarging after the Cold War, or sorting out the Balkans, or trying to embrace Russia, or more latterly, dealing with Afghanistan, but at least it gave NATO a sense of purpose. I used to say that NATO was good for the Balkans, but the Balkans were probably even better for NATO, in the sense that after the Cold War, they gave us a new focal point, where many of the assets that we'd built up to confront the Soviet Union, like integrated command structures and forces that could work together, could be converted to peacekeeping duties. But now, as we come out of Afghanistan, we're confronted, I think, with a situation which is rather unprecedented for the alliance. For the first time since 1949, we don't have a clear threat or a clear reference point, a clear sort of greatest danger of dangers. which can focus our planning activities and bring us together. If you give allies today a list of threats, you'd probably find that many of the same things would crop up on their shopping list, but in a very different order. And often they wouldn't be talking about the same thing. For example, terrorism for the French means a different area of the world, Mali, Niger, with different organisations than terrorism for the British or for the United States, for instance. Number one. Number two, we now, instead of facing one big threat, face a whole sort of range of different threats, and different allies ascribe different priorities to those, but these threats come in the form more of flows. They're more interconnected things. The way, for example, in which organised crime is increasingly showing up in terrorism or the narcotics trade, for instance, or is more linked to environmental or governance factors. And therefore, in the defence world, there's now much more confusion than there used to be about whether you sort of get at these threats via the finance route or via the legal route or by the nation-building route or by the traditional defence route, which makes it harder, of course, for NATO to sort of situate itself on that spectrum. As you said, my dear Lord, at the beginning, the United States is no longer the default option in the alliance. The three previous Secretaries of Defence, beginning with the Gates speech in Brussels and now with Mr. Panetta and more recently with Hagel, they've all pointed it out. The US doesn't have the means nor the will any longer to provide the kind of capabilities that the US feels the Europeans should be able to provide themselves. And as we come out of Afghanistan, there is now a big debate opening up in NATO between those, many of them in Central and Eastern Europe, who see the end of Afghanistan as a kind of breathing space for NATO to come home to the barracks in Europe and go back to its traditional mission of border collective defence in Europe, which was somewhat neglected while we were diverted in Helmand or Uruzgan or the Hindu Kush. And another group who believes that, no, the global orientation of NATO, which we've pursued since Afghanistan, is the one that best corresponds to our security interests in a globalised world and is the one that's best geared to keep NATO in business. The big question, however, is can you remain global without 150,000 troops in Asia? You know, how do you sort of keep a global orientation and global activities if you don't have the big enchilada of a mission as a kind of locomotive to drive things forward? So we have a situation where the world is changing, at a time where NATO also internally is changing. Normally, if you're in politics, as many of you have been, you could sort of cope with one and not the other. You know, you could cope with internal change if the external parameters remain stable, or cope with the external parameters as long as internally you maintain your cohesion. But when the two are increasingly linked and are fragmenting at the same time, this is difficult. The Secretary General often likes to point out that we have a triple burden sharing problem in the alliance at the moment. We have the fact that, for example, in 10 years ago, even less than that, Europe, the NATO total of world global defence spending was 69%, Europe and the US together. By 2011, it was only 60%. Today it's 55%. So the first differential is between NATO vis-a-vis China, Russia, India, and the rest of the world. Secondly, it's between Europe and the United States. 10 years ago, the Europeans were still at about 45 to 55% in terms of defence spending vis-à-vis the United States. Today, the US is 72% of the NATO total. And then finally, the third sort of differential is within Europe itself, where the UK and France together are 45% of all EU 28 countries' defence spending. You put Germany into the mix, it goes up to 65%. And if you add research and development, it goes up to 88%. So the problem today is that increasingly in an alliance of 28 countries, only one or two or three are able to provide real defence capability. And the small and medium-sized countries that form the great majority of our member states are less and less able to contribute anything at all. But how can you therefore have an alliance where ultimately only size matters and you have to sort of basically give a free pass to the majority of your membership when it comes to burden sharing? Clearly you can't do this. So what is it reasonable to ask them to? So faced with these issues as we come out of Afghanistan, what is the first thing that we have to do? Well, the first thing is, of course, we have to keep NATO capable. you know, even if it may take some time to figure out where the next big operation is going to be or where the next big threat will be that NATO will confront, the key thing is that we have to give NATO at least the wherewithal to still be a militarily relevant alliance in the 21st century. This means four things, and these four things are what I'd like to briefly focus on today. First one, stay connected. The military forces coming out of Afghanistan, going back to their barracks, are smaller than what we've known before. For example, the UK went into Afghanistan being able to deploy 20,000 troops at any one time. It comes out of Afghanistan with 6,000. France went into Afghanistan being able to deploy 30,000 troops. The current white paper in France puts that figure down at 15,000 troops. So clearly, all of us are now going to have much smaller forces. But those coming out of Afghanistan are more capable, more interoperable, more blooded than what we've had before. Many little groups have formed in Afghanistan. For example, the Brits with the Danes and the Estonians that have achieved a very high degree of defence integration and trust. The Nordics, the same. The Visegrad countries, the same. There's been a great deal of pooling and sharing of effort. The problem, of course, is that within a couple of years of coming back to Europe, much of that will inevitably disappear. Like any athlete that stops training, the fitness, the skills dwindle very quickly. And we could have a long hiatus before NATO engages somewhere again. So how do we therefore maintain this interoperability, this connectedness? The answer is something called the Connected Forces Initiative, which defence ministers in October in NATO are due to approve. But essentially it has a number of challenges. The military, of course, as you can imagine, would like to have an enormous number of exercises. Some on collective defence, Article 5, others more about, you know, integrated approaches with civilian organisations or the police, others more about deployment. A very intensive schedule of activities. I don't think the money is going to be there for that. Nations are also very reluctant to commit themselves to a multi-year sort of training programme. Yes to the next exercise, big question marks after it. The United States, as you quite said, my Lord, at the beginning, with sequestration, is cutting in precisely this area that NATO needs most, paradoxically, which is the education, training, exercises area. For example, we're having an exercise called Steadfast Jazz in the Baltic States in a couple of weeks' time after the summer break, our first major sort of Article 5 exercise for several years. The US is sending a company at the moment, and not the brigades that were suggested recently by Secretary Panetta. So clearly that is going to put a question mark over the ability of the Europeans to remain connected to the United States. The other thing, of course, is that NATO now, for the first time, has to rely on a much closer interaction between the multinational structures that we've built up in Brussels and the national structures. Paradoxically, for an alliance that's been in the business for well over 60 years, we don't have a high degree of articulation or interaction between the national headquarters and force structures and the multinational ones. And so you've got a lot of people in national structures who have never served in NATO, as we discovered during the Libyan operation, where we had to go and find people from the national structures, particularly to do targeting or weaponry, who had no experience of the NATO procedure. So how do we bring those things together? How do we do smart exercises so that we ensure that we get the maximum benefit when we can afford money to put one of these very expensive things on? One idea circulating in Brussels is we should try to marry up with the EU in this area. They've got battle groups, excuse me, which have never been used. We've got our NATO response force, you know, the similar sort of certification, similar modes of operation. I apologise, I think the sausages are going down my throat too slowly today. How can we, therefore, sort of do sort of joint exercises together? Thank you, I'll take some water. Next problem with connected forces is what do you exercise for? Of course, thank you very much. The obvious thing to do is to say, well, look, let's exercise our contingency plans. You know, we have contingency plans for Article 5, the defence of Poland, the defence of the Baltic States. That's logical, right? You know, tie your exercise to an actual military operational plan. The problem is if we do that, the exercises will be purely collective defence. Secondly, the signal will go to Russia that NATO is once again sort of basically spending its time in Central and Eastern Europe preparing, you know, for the old Cold War scenarios. That is not something, ultimately, I think that's in our interest that happen. I think we need to make sure that we don't have all of our exercises in Central and Eastern Europe. For example, in 2015, we're planning to have one in Portugal and Spain. Good. You know, not all on the Russian border. Although how we have leverage our exercises to get the Russians to be more transparent about their exercises is also going to be a big political issue. But the first challenge, therefore, is, you know, how do we keep the connectivity going? You know, how much is enough? Below which, of course, gradually, we're going to go back to the heavy metal, non-deployable, static armies in the barracks that we had before. Second major challenge, defence integration. Virtually every expert you talk to sees no way out of the European capability problems at the moment, the declining defence budgets. Two-thirds of the Allies have cut their defence budgets by more than 15%. Over the last 5 years. Today we have an alliance where half the members contribute together only 1.5% of the total defence spending together. We have five allies that together make up nearly 90% of defence spending. So clearly, looking to nations alone to provide a full spectrum of forces is not going to be something that we can rely upon in the future. So integration, multinational capabilities, pooling and sharing is the way ahead. Some believe firmly that the time has come for a kind of European army, or at least what's called in Brussels a full European spectrum of forces, that this has to be organised along sort of EU-European lines, around sort of ideas of sort of common procurement of transport aircraft, common air defence, development of a European sort of drone capability, European air tankers, whatever. Others, while still acknowledging, ladies and gentlemen, that we're going to have some kind of European solution, don't really want to talk about it politically as a kind of EU army or an EU spectrum, because they argue, my lord, you said that if, you know, the US is repositioning to the Asia-Pacific area, politically, the last thing you want then to do is sort of divide the NATO full structure down the middle and have a bifurcated sort of North American structure and a European structure, because that will accentuate, if you like, the strategic drift even more. But whether, you know, you see this solution as a kind of European integration effort or not, virtually everybody in Brussels is arguing at least that we need what's called a coherent set of forces. We need to integrate. The question is how do we get there? First idea was basically having a 50-50 split with the United States. The problem for the Europeans at the moment is, of course, that basically we have in NATO more than we need in many important categories. For example, the Americans have 680 refueling tanker aircraft. That is double the NATO requirement. So should Europeans invest in tanker aircraft? Many in Europe say yes, they should, because can we rely in this new situation on the United States to provide these assets? And if not, then we have to start duplicating. So should Europeans develop in the areas not covered by the US or covered? So should we have a 50-50 that no ally, i.e. the United States, should be expected to provide more than 50% of a capability? The problem is meeting this goal is impossible in any short time frame for most Europeans. Secondly, should the answer be regional groups? I described these earlier, the regional groups that have sort of grown up in Eastern Europe, the Benelux group, the Anglo-French cooperation in defence, the Lancaster House Treaty, just around the corner of a few years ago. Is this the way that these groups then should sort of denote capabilities to the alliance? Or should instead the UK, France and Germany act as so-called framework nations? In other words, these three big countries come forward and say, right, we will be, if you like, the spine, the command, the control, the core of a capability, and the Slovaks and the Czechs and the Belgians and the Dutch, you know, will sort of hook on in the best way that they can, so that everybody contributes and we have the capabilities that way. The French have come up with another idea, which is called burden pooling, not burden sharing, where they argue that Europeans should just sort of mix into consortium, like a European air transport consortium that exists already, 150 aircraft, pooled by five European nations and pooled our capabilities into a kind of reservoir from which people can draw. What are the problems here? Well, the first problem, of course, is getting this off the drawing board. I mean, many of these are studies. Number two, many of them concern capabilities like helicopters or air transport aircraft that we started in the 1980s and are only coming on stream now. And very few concern capabilities that we're going to need in 20 years' time. Number three, many of them are about standards rather than about actual projects. And number four, many of them are fine. You know, you merge your tennis court and I merge my tennis court. Great, you know, we save money. But merging tennis courts does not help frontline troops. So we have to try to direct these smart, so-called smart defence programmes to areas where NATO really has requirements. But this is going to be one of the biggest challenges. Before we get below the sort of critical level that European capabilities decline absolutely vis-a-vis the rest of the world, and we can do nothing more than very small operations in the neighbourhood, how do we sort of rationalise the European defence market, even in the industrial side? EU has 9 big defence contractors, 10 smaller ones, which is double more than the United States, even today, in both those categories. So how do we deal with this overcapacity? How do we merge in a way that, particularly to a country like the UK, where I don't have to start talking about our debate, national debates on the EU, or countries like France, which are preoccupied with sovereignty, with strategic autonomy, in a way which marries, you know, sort of hard defence economics and political sovereignty and acceptability. Massive challenge. Number three, very briefly, cyber. There are many in NATO, so we don't really need to do much about a cyber attack because we're not yet at the stage where cyber is a threat at the same level as nuclear weapons or proliferation of chemical biological weapons or large conventional threats. Certainly, maybe not so far in terms of killing large numbers of people, but I think we are very close to the stage where cyber is now a strategic threat to the alliance, on operations, to our command and control, to the integrity of our systems, and it's time that we started upping our game. We've made a lot of progress in this area over the last couple of years. We have a very good NATO cyber centre of excellence in Estonia. We have an NSERC, which does our day-to-day cyber incident response centre protection. We have memoranda of understanding on cyber defence with a number of allies, and we do exercises. But we have three big issues that we still need to address. If we are to sort of equip NATO for cyber conflict, or even protect our members against cyber attack. The first one is assistance to allies. We still have quite significant disagreements among allies as to whether, if an ally is attacked, you know, NATO should come to the defence. Some allies say, no, you know, I've invested heavily in national cyber capabilities. I'm not going to pay twice. I'm not going to pay twice, you know, to then invest in a NATO one. You know, everybody has to assume their responsibility. Whereas other allies say, hey, look, you know, I'm contributing financially to a NATO common capability. And are you trying to tell me that if I'm attacked, I can't access that capability? You're not going to let me sort of, you know, have some of it back to protect myself. In that case, I'm not going to bother to invest in the first place. So the arguments are finally balanced. Is cyber an Article 5 collective defence? We had a defence minister's meeting in NATO a few weeks ago when virtually half of them said, no, it's not. You know, I can't conceive of any instance in which a cyber attack, no matter how paralysing or, you know, embarrassing or compromising in terms of the banking sector, would actually be a sort of a casus belli Article 5. Others said with equal passion that of course it could be and we should prepare for it. So we basically need to sort of sort out a common NATO view on the strategic relevance of cyber and what NATO's role should be. Second thing is we've got to start getting all allies up to at least a minimal standard of cyber protection by setting standards, by setting targets. We've started to do that for the first time this year. And thirdly, we've got to get our military to actually look at a major sort of military cyber event and let us know what we need in terms of capabilities. I mean, the military often go around saying, you know, cyber is the area, like the former Supreme Allied Commander, Stavridis. Cyber is the area where there's the greatest sort of, you know, gap between the threat and NATO's preparedness. But often when you say to the military, and if there are any here, please accept this with good grace, but, you know, when you say to them, well, what sort of capabilities do you need, therefore, to plug this gap? I don't really know. You know, we know how many tanks we need and aircraft and missiles and pipelines, but what is a military cyber capability? What does a military cyber contingency plan look like? This is what we need to clarify. Final challenge, and then I'll stop and we'll get into questions. The maritime component. One of the things that's going to be, I think, important in the years to come, as our land forces come back to Europe and probably for some time to come, apart from small operations by special forces, most of them stay in the barracks. The bulk of the sort of things that the land forces were doing for us over the last 10 years is going to be transferred to the maritime dimension. You know, for example, forming partnerships and relationships with the Chinese or the Indians, acting as our eyes and ears in terms of intelligence gathering in the wider world, for instance. You know, if you look at, for example, the tasks that are going on to the maritime domain at the moment, they are quite impressive. You know, there's this idea of support for land operations. There's this idea of keeping the sea lanes of communication open, as 90% of world trade goes by sea. And you think of choke points like the Straits of Hormuz or Malacca Straits. They are increasingly being used in counter-piracy operations, now looking more to the Gulf of Guinea after the time in the Gulf of Aden. They're increasingly being seen as an arm for interdicting trafficking, human trafficking, small arms trafficking, trafficking in chemicals and other components and support of the customs. They're increasingly being used to protect critical infrastructure at sea as more and more of oil is actually now being extracted as well as transported at sea. And yet the naval area is one which has suffered some of the biggest cuts, both in terms of platforms and budgets, in NATO. So we need, I think, and this is going to be a key feature of NATO's next summit next year, to develop a NATO sort of maritime strategy for how we start boosting our NATO forces. For example, one click here is law. You know, maritime operations often are in a legal black hole. We saw this with piracy. You know, what do you do with the pirates? And we went into the piracy operation with different NATO countries having different rules of engagement because of different legal interpretations. So I think we need to do something about that. There's the whole business of information exchange. Dame Glyn Evans is here, and we could talk at great length about the role of private security companies and the private sector. Also in maritime protection, which is something which we need to factor into our planning. How do we, for example, also have maritime patrol aircraft? As we have fewer and fewer ships, maritime operations are becoming increasingly dependent upon sensors and satellites and maritime awareness, you know, and how do we put the two together? I could talk at great length about this, and I'm sure I've convinced you of that already, but the point I want to make is that, you know, we need to anticipate the future now and increasingly sort of go maritime and develop that as well. So those are four things to keep NATO in business, but of course, if we develop them, there is still going to be, as I said, this argument, and I come back to where I started, between, you know, the sort of come back to Europe, let's have a rest to rebuild after Afghanistan, let's go back to NATO's traditional role as a European security organisation, and the globalists, who argue that there's no going back to the old Article 5 mission of NATO. If it doesn't remain global, it will increasingly lose relevance. And not just to the United States. I'm in the globalist camp, but I accept that there are a couple of things that we need to pay attention to if we're able to remain relevant without an Afghanistan. The first one is, as we do fewer operations ourselves, can't we do more to help the other guys? You know, the African Union in Somalia, the UN now sending 12,000 troops into Mali. The guys who are doing the operations, but who badly need financing, who need training, who need medical evacuation, who need in extremis support. I mean, interestingly, you may have seen a couple of days ago some UN commanders in Africa asking the international community to give them drones so that they could acquire greater situational awareness. And I argue that it would be a great tragedy, for, you know, just in one example, if NATO, having spent $60 billion, this is my area, $60 billion on countering the threat of roadside bombs in Afghanistan, you know, was unwilling or unable to pass all of this know-how and technology to the UN, who are now being blown up by roadside bombs in Mali elsewhere. You know, we've got 18 centres of excellence that train our own troops. Why don't we train the African Union or the UN or others? You know, to the extent we sort of become a supporting organisation rather than a leading organisation, it will be less sexy. Of course it will. You know, it's great to be the leader. But it's also, I think, at a time of financial constraint, in our interest to encourage others to take on a security burden. The second thing that we have to do is define NATO's role in homeland defence. I started with cyber. There's terrorism, you know, there's freak weather conditions, there's borders. I saw the other day, for example, Roussi, the incoming head of the UK, the chief of the General Staff, gave a speech basically saying, you know, if I'm not badly presenting what he said, I only saw the press reports, but, you know, the army now has to play a bigger role in domestic defence because we're not so much needed outside. Well, is that the way to go? And if so, you know, what should NATO's role be alongside the police, the intelligence services, the fire brigade? I know the army played a useful role during the Olympic Games here last year, dealing with site security. But, you know, should the military stay out there, or is there scope for them to be more involved in homeland defence? Third thing, almost finished, partners. I mentioned earlier that we've got this very extensive network of partners, 26 of them. Are in Afghanistan alongside us. They provide 6,000 troops. How do we keep that network of partnerships vibrant and active once the operations have come to an end? It would be a great pity, you know, to see the Australians go home or the Tongolese go back to Tonga or whatever and have to start all over again from scratch the next time we have an operation. So how do, of course, the partners, having been with us in Afghanistan, think of Sweden or Finland, have got a great expectation that they're now sort of virtually allies and should be treated as such. So how far should we go in incorporating into sort of, you know, core NATO business countries which are not NATO members, which are not seeking NATO membership, but which have demonstrated that they've got a lot to offer? So should we be less of an organisation and more of a kind of network? And then finally, in a world where we can't really any longer deal with every threat, how can we better equip NATO in terms of intelligence, in terms of early warning, to sort of predict a little bit better than we've done in the past where the next crisis is going to come from, and use more political preventative means to deal with the situation instead of always being reactive and using military forces late in the day? So in other words, you know, the organisation needs a genius like me, frankly. That's off the record. Well, it certainly needs geniuses like you because, you know, frankly, if these were easy problems, you probably wouldn't need NATO, right? You know, security needs very intelligent people because precisely the problems are so intractable. But I want to finish on a more sober note, and then I finish. It is a tricky time. It is, as I say. We're coming out of a world which, even after the Cold War, we make apparently simple. You know, the enemies didn't put up any resistance. You know, the threats could be seen. Russia and China were more or less prepared to let us do what we felt we had to do. At least rhetorically they made noises, but they didn't try in any way to block us. The biggest problem was simply getting NATO to agree. The rest of the world took care of itself. That is not true any longer. And therefore, if we want to keep this organisation, we're probably going to have to invest not only financially in it, but a lot more intellectually on both sides of the Atlantic than we have done, and find a way sort of through the woods. Too often in Europe, you know, NATO is what the Americans do for us. Too often in the United States, NATO is us. That's the Europeans filling in all the gaps that we don't want to take care of ourselves. It's never us. And we're going to have to sort of build that relationship. The question I leave it with, there are some people in Brussels who think we don't need to bother in the security world any longer. The transatlantic trade pact is all we need to keep the two halves of the Atlantic united. I'm not so sure. I think if we want a good transatlantic relationship, it has to exist in the security area as well. And therefore, the next NATO summit should not just be about how do we get out of Afghanistan, but, you know, what is going to be the future of the alliance thereafter. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and I'll now take your questions.